Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. This year, we celebrate the centennial of the 19th Amendment, which granted women the right to vote. South Dakota considered the issue many times before the matter was added to the United States Constitution, but just as many argued in favor of suffrage, many others argued against. We're joined now by Paula Nelson. She's an emeritus professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. She's also the author of multiple books about Great Plains and South Dakota history, and she wrote the chapter called Defending Separate Spheres, Anti-Suffrage Women in South Dakota Suffrage Campaigns. That's featured in the book Equality at the Ballot Box from the South Dakota Historical Society Press. Paula Nelson, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for taking time for us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you mention in this chapter that South Dakota may have discussed and voted on women's suffrage more than almost any other Great Plains state. Walk us through a little bit why you say that.
Well, during territorial days, there was discussion of it at least four times. And in fact, the legislature actually passed it, but the governor at the time vetoed it because he was afraid that the state would not be admitted into the union if it came in with women's suffrage. So there were some very close discussions and close opportunities in the territorial days. What finally happened is that the South Dakota Constitution was written with the pledge to have an election in 1890, right after statehood, where the public in South Dakota, male voters, of course, would vote about women's suffrage and make a decision about whether or not the state should have it. So then that started a series of contests. In most cases, with each contest, the anti-suffrage votes became fewer and fewer, but of course it took until 1918 to actually get enough pro-suffrage votes to put it across. So it took endless amount of work. And it took a lot of work for people who opposed it to stand up every time and say, this isn't a good idea. So it was a contest of some magnitude in South Dakota.
Talk to us about the root of the opposition to women's suffrage.
The anti-suffrage, anti-women's suffrage movement comes out of a couple of different basic ideas. First of all, the strong sense that men and women were different and had different duties and obligations in society. And women had domestic and cultural duties. You know, by the time South Dakota started voting on suffrage in 1890, their women were really doing an awful lot of things in terms of public service, volunteer work, you know, charity work, and all those kinds of things. So they felt they had a strong cultural contribution, and that was one of the best things for them to do, that the culture was the most important thing. Culture and the public influenced legislators and got them to pass laws, and where voting is just one vote by one person, it doesn't have the same kind of impact. So their emphasis was on the difference between men and women and the impact of culture and the way that women were deeply engrossed in culture throughout society. The second main idea was the fact that the women who were anti-suffrage tended to believe very strongly in home and family. Now, they were often outside their homes, sometimes even working for wages outside their homes. They were doing all these cultural kinds of things, but what they meant by loyalty to home was the idea that the home, in a way, is a sacred place, and that to be a wife and a mother had special status and special meaning in society. And they were very afraid that with the shift in the place of women in society with suffrage, because it puts women, again, in public action, and, you know, political action, which had always been male, that being a wife and mother would become just another job, you know, that it would be demeaned and devalued and it would undermine the family. So that was the second main issue that they were worried about.
Interesting. And you raised the point that I think it can sometimes be lost as we think about the move for women's suffrage, is that not all women were united in this move to allow women to vote. You talk a bit in this chapter about a particular woman in South Dakota. Tell us a little bit more, if you would, about Marietta Bones and her role in this.
Such an interesting person. Very, I think, dynamic, probably impressive to know, almost maybe frightening in a way to know, because she was a strong personality. But she had been in favor of suffrage. But when she saw the way that the suffrage groups worked with the national leadership, and when they tried to put some controls on her to get her to stop being so kind of dominant and bossy, she rebelled against the whole movement, turned against it, and became a staunch advocate of anti-suffrage. And I think there's more than one scholar who has studied her that thinks that her role as an anti-suffragist was very important in keeping South Dakota from passing women's suffrage for a long, long time. She just was very dominant and had quite a personality.
Wow, how interesting.
Well, yeah. She's a difficult person to know what to do. What do you do with a person like that? You know, who is just everywhere she goes, when she walks into the room, everybody knows she's there. Mm. Very hard to fight against that kind of thing. And she actually sued the Aberdeen paper and 30 of her former friends in, God, I can't remember the name of the town now, where she had lived, who had chided her for her actions, and sued them for $50,000, which was a huge sum of money at that time.
Right.
It never did go to court, and she eventually dropped it. But it shows you the type that she doesn't care what other people think about her.
Wow.
She's going to stick to her principles.
Huh. I can't help but draw a parallel between Marietta and how she maybe, I don't know if you want to say flip-flopped, but just in her irritation with how she was treated by the suffrage movement, moved to the other side of the argument. And I hear sometimes similar stories with women today who are irritated with how they're treated by the broader feminist movement. So they argue sometimes in another direction, and we see that throughout. Do you see those kind of situations echo through your study of this issue?
Well, I think in Marietta Bowen's case, she put it in terms of becoming more aware of how unable to handle the ballot women were because of the way they treated her.
Hmm.
You know, in other words, she turned it into an abstraction.
Right.
That it's not just that they were mean to me, but this indicates character flaws and weakness that shows that they just really don't deserve the vote, that they're not ready for the vote, that they don't have the appropriate mental attributes to run the vote.
Interesting.
And I think today it's really hard to extrapolate from one era to another, because today I think a lot of times people who had been feminists turn against it because they think it's become either too radical or challenges the family too much, or mm-hmm. they are going in favor of certain issues that the public or that this particular person, say, doesn't care for. And so they turn against it, again, they would say it's on principle or on an abstraction, that the direction is not the way that it should go.
Hmm.
Yeah, people do that all the time.
Right. you also talk in this chapter about certain industries were leery of women voting. What can you tell us about that?
Well, there's several industries. In South Dakota, the one that was the most involved in opposition to suffrage, was the liquor industry, because suffrage for many people was wrapped up with the WCTU, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and the advocacy of temperance or banning of all alcohol. And that, of course, made them very worried and concerned, because that's how they made their living. And they also understood that they had customers who were culturally involved with liquor. I mean, they were people who had come from countries where liquor was just incorporated into the daily, you know, you might have beer for a meal, that kind of thing. And so they didn't come here seeing it as a sin as many kind of middle-class reformers had come to see it. So the liquor industry was very concerned and worried about women voting for fear that most of them would be temperance advocates and then liquor would be lost. Hmm. Now, in other places, like in the South, they had industries where they had used child labor and used a lot of women who worked. And reform included things like no more child labor and counting the hours, limiting the hours that women worked at factories. So that would be a direct blow at their livelihood. So they opposed it for that reason. So, you know, it varies. And sometimes it's just for individuals, it's the sense that there is a natural order. And men are supposed to be the public people and women are supposed to be the home people. And so it violates that very fundamental natural order. Hmm. So you have at one level the individual response against it, and you have organized corporate responses against it because of it, the way it aims at livelihood.
Interesting. Another move against suffrage, and I've only read this word, I might be mispronouncing it, but the organization called the Remonstrance, I think.
I've never been quite sure. they changed the name later and just called themselves Antis.
Well, that's easier.
They moved because nobody could understand the other word. Although it did have a meaning to remonstrate against something, a piece of legislation or something like that, was a public opportunity. I mean, that was something that people could do against legislation that they didn't like. So what they're remonstrating against is the movement toward suffrage at either the state level or their worst fear, the national level. They were afraid that if a lot of states voted for women's suffrage, pretty soon it would make sense to have a national amendment and include everybody. And then that would be the worst-case scenario because you couldn't have a haven in one state, for example.
Hmm. You also talk a little bit in this chapter, as we start to wrap up today, about the role of newspapers in this and folks sending different literature to newspapers. Can we end on that note, the role of newspapers in this movement in South Dakota?
Newspapers were so important in South Dakota and really just about anywhere in the rural areas of the Midwest. And Great Plains, because they were the place where people advertised, they disseminated information. You could open the paper and see what the big subjects were. It was very important. And the anti-suffrage people, I think pro-suffrage people thought that they were very wealthy and had a lot of money and that they were getting it from the liquor movement and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't the case. They would ask women to chip in a donation, and women would open their purses and donate. You know, it was very ad hoc. They didn't have big funding. But what they did with it was very wise because they reached the greater number of people by using newspaper ads where they could phrase the argument in terms that made sense to the public, reach out to people that they would never really have a chance to talk to in person, and then make sense of their arguments and hope to convince others. So newspapers played a vital role, really for both sides, of course, but antis used it very well. And they would send out flyers and forms, and they had that newspaper, the Remonstrance, for quite a while, too. Hmm. And then they later changed its name to something a little bit more understandable and published it as kind of a journal frequently for people to read. So they had a very good sense of how to reach out to the public.
My guest has been Paula Nelson, historian and author of the chapter Defending Separate Spheres, the Anti-Suffrage Women in South Dakota Suffrage Campaigns. Paula Nelson, thanks for joining us today.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.